The Quagmires tried to comfort them, promising to double their research efforts, but Violet, Klaus, and Sunny were too tired for conversation, even with their closest friends. Luckily, their closest friends understood completely and didn't find the Baudelaire silence rude or discouraging. It seems impossible to believe that the three Baudelaires managed to survive another evening of S.O.R.E., but in times of extreme stress, one can often find energy hidden in even the most exhausted areas of the body. I discovered this myself when I was woken up in the middle of the night and chased 16 miles by an angry mob armed with torches, swords, and vicious dogs. And the Baudelaire orphans discovered it as they ran laps, not only for that night, but also for 6 nights following. This made a grand total of 9 S.O.R.E. sessions, although grand would seem to be the wrong word for endless evenings of desperate panting, sweaty bodies, and achy legs. For 9 nights, the Baudelaire brains were plagued with the symbolic luminous zero glowing in their minds like a giant donut of despair. As the Baudelaire orphans suffered, their schoolwork suffered with them. As I'm sure you know, a good night's sleep helps you perform well in school. And so if you are a student, you should always get a good night's sleep, unless you have come to the good part of your book, and then you should stay up all night and let your schoolwork fall by the wayside, a phrase which means flunk. In the days that followed, the Baudelaires were much more exhausted than somebody who had stayed up all night reading, and their schoolwork did more than fall by the wayside. It fell off the wayside, a phrase which here has different meanings for each child. For Violet, it meant that she was so drowsy that she did not write down a single word of Mr. Amora's stories. For Klaus, it meant that he was so weary that he didn't measure a single one of Mrs. Bass's objects. And for Sunny, it meant that she was so exhausted that she didn't do anything Vice Principal Nero assigned her to do. The Baudelaire orphans believed that doing well in school was extremely important, even if the school happened to be run by a tyrannical idiot. But they were simply too fatigued from their nightly laps to do their assigned work. Before long, the circle of luminous paint was not the only zero the Baudelaire saw. Violet saw a zero at the top of her paper when she was unable to recall any of Mr. Romora's stories for a test. Klaus saw a zero in Mrs. Bass's gradebook when he was called on to report the exact length of a tube sock he was supposed to be measuring, and was discovered to be taking a nap instead. And Sunny saw a zero when she checked the staple drawer and saw that there were 0 staples inside. "This is getting ridiculous," Isadora said when Sunny updated her siblings and friends at the start of another weary lunch. "Look at you, Sunny. It was inappropriate to hire you as an administrative assistant in the first place, and it's simply absurd to have you crawl laps by night and make your own staples by day." "Don't call my sister absurd or ridiculous," Klaus cried. "I'm not calling her ridiculous," Isadora said. "I'm calling the situation ridiculous." "Ridiculous means you want to laugh at it," said Klaus, who was never too tired to define words, "and I don't want you laughing at us." "I'm not laughing at you," Isadora said. "I'm trying to help." Klaus snatched his drinking glass from Isadora's side of the table. "Well, laughing at us doesn't help at all, you cake sniffer." Isadora snatched her silverware from Klaus's hands. "Calling me names doesn't help either, Klaus." "Mum-dum!" Sunny shrieked. "Oh, stop it, both of you," Duncan said. "Isadora, can't you see that Klaus is just tired? And Klaus, can't you see that Isadora is just frustrated?" Klaus took his glasses off and returned his drinking glass to Isadora. "I'm too tired to see anything," he said. "I'm sorry, Isadora. Being tired makes me crabby. In a few days I'll turn as nasty as Carmelita Spatz." Isadora handed her silverware back to Klaus and patted him on the hand in forgiveness. "You'll never be as nasty as Carmelita Spatz," she said.
"Carmelita Spatz?"
Violet said, lifting her head from her tray. She had dozed through Isadora and Klaus's argument, but had woken up at the sound of the special messenger's name. "She's not coming here again to tell us to do laps, is she?" "I'm afraid she is," Duncan said ruefully, a word which here means, while pointing at a rude, violent, and filthy little girl.
"Hello, cake sniffers,"
Carmelita Spatz said.
"Today I have 2 messages for you, so I should really get 2 tips instead of 1.
"Oh, Carmelita," Klaus said, "you haven't gotten a tip for the last 9 days, and I see no reason to break that tradition."
"That's because you're a stupid orphan,"
Carmelita Spatz said promptly.
"In any case, message number one is the usual. Meet Coach Genghis on the front lawn right after dinner.
Violet gave an exhausted groan. And what's the second message? She asked.
The second message is that you must report to Vice Principal Nero's office right away.
Vice Principal Nero's office? Klaus asked. Why?
I'm sorry,
Carmelita Spatz said, with a nasty smile to indicate she wasn't sorry one bit.
I don't answer questions from non-tipping orphan cake sniffers.
Some children at the neighboring table laughed when they heard that and began banging their silverware on the table.
Cake sniffing orphans in the orphan shack! Cake sniffing orphans in the orphan shack!
They chanted as Carmelita Spatz giggled and skipped off to finish her lunch.
Cake sniffing orphans in the orphan shack! Cake sniffing orphans in the orphan shack!
They chanted while the Baudelaire sighed and stood up on their aching legs. We'd better go to Nero's, Violet said. We'll see you later, Duncan and Isadora. Nonsense, Duncan said. We'll walk you. Carmelita Spatz has made me lose my appetite, so we'll skip lunch and take you to the administrative building. We won't go inside. Otherwise there'll be no silverware between the five of us. But we'll wait outside and you can tell us what's going on. I wonder what Nero wants, Klaus said, yawning. Maybe he's discovered that Genghis is really Olaf all by himself, Isadora said, and the Baudelaire smiled back. They didn't dare hope that this was the reason for their summons to Nero's office, but they appreciated their friend's hopefulness. The five children handed their scarcely eaten lunches to the cafeteria workers, who blinked at them silently from behind their metal masks, and walked to the administrative building. The Quagmire triplets wished the Baudelaires luck, and Violet, Klaus, and Sunny trudged up the steps to Nero's office.
Thank you for taking the time out of your busy orphan schedule to see me,
Vice Principal Nero said, yanking open his door before they could knock.
Hurry up and come inside. Every minute I spend talking to you is a minute I could spend practicing the violin. And when you're a musical genius like me, every minute counts.
The three children walked into the tiny office and began clapping their tired hands together as Nero raised both arms in the air.
There are two things I wanted to talk to you about, he said when the applause was over. Do you know what they are?
No, sir, Violet replied.
No, sir,
Nero mimicked, although he looked disappointed that the children hadn't given him a longer answer to make fun of.
Well, the first one is that the three of you have missed 9 of my violin concerts, and each of you owes me a bag of candy for each one. 9 bags of candy times 3 equals 29. In addition, Carmelita Spatz has told me that she has delivered 10 messages to you, if you include the 2 she delivered today, and that you've never given her a tip. That's a disgrace. Now, I think a nice tip is a pair of earrings with precious stones. So you owe her 10 pairs of earrings. What do you have to say about that?
The Baudelaire orphans looked at one another with their sleepy, sleepy eyes. They had nothing to say about that. That they'd only missed Nero's concerts because Coach Genghis had forced them to. That 9 bags of candy times 3 equals 27, not 29. And that tips are always optional and usually consist of money instead of earrings. But Violet, Klaus, and Sunny were too tired to say anything about it at all. This was another disappointment to Vice Principal Nero, who stood there scratching his pigtails and waiting for one of the children to say something that he could repeat in his nasty, mocking voice. But after a moment of silence, the Vice Principal went on to the second thing.
The second thing, he said, going on, is that you three have become the worst students Prufrock Preparatory School has ever seen. Violet, Mr. Amora tells me that you have flunked a test. Klaus, Mrs. Bass reports that you can scarcely tell one end of a metric ruler from another. And, Sonny, I've noticed that you haven't made a single staple. Mr. Poe told me you were intelligent and hard-working children, but you're just a bunch of cake sniffers.
At this, the Baudelaires could keep quiet no longer.
We're flunking school because we're exhausted, Violet cried. And we're exhausted because we're running laps every night,
Klaus cried.
Galooka! Sonny shrieked. Which meant, so yell at Coach Genghis, not at us.
Vice Principal Nero gave the children a big smile, delighted that he was able to answer them in his favorite way.
We're flunking school because we're exhausted,
he squealed.
And we're exhausted because we're running laps every night. Galooka!
I've had enough of your nonsense. Prufrock Preparatory School has promised you an excellent education. And an excellent education you will get. Or, in Sunny's case, an excellent job as an administrative assistant. Now, I've instructed Mr. Amora and Mrs. Bass to give comprehensive exams tomorrow. Large tests on absolutely everything you've learned so far. Violet, you'd better remember every detail of Mr. Amora's stories. And Klaus, you'd better remember the length, width, and depths of Mrs. Bass's objects, or I will expel you from school. Also, I've found a bunch of papers that need to be stapled tomorrow. Sunny, you will staple all of them with homemade staples, or I will expel you from your job. First thing tomorrow morning, we will have the test and the stapling, and if you don't get A's and make enough staples, you'll leave Prufrock Preparatory School. Luckily for you, Coach Genghis has offered to homeschool you. That means he'd be your coach, your teacher, and your guardian all in one. It's a very generous offer, and if I were you, I'd give him a tip too, although I don't think earrings are appropriate in this case. We're not going to give Count Olaf a tip, Violet blurted out.
Klaus looked at his older sister in horror. Violet means Coach Genghis, Klaus said quickly to Nero.
I do not, Violet cried. Klaus, our situation is too desperate to pretend not to recognize him any longer.
Hifiju,
Sunny agreed. I guess you're right, Klaus said. What have we got to lose?
What have we got to lose?
Nero mocked.
What are you talking about?
We're talking about Coach Genghis, Violet said. He's not really named Genghis. He's not even a real coach. He's Count Olaf in disguise.
Nonsense,
Nero said.
Klaus wanted to say,
nonsense,
right back at Nero, in Nero's own repulsive way, but he bit his exhausted tongue. It's true, he said. He's put a turban over his eyebrow and expensive running shoes over his tattoo, but he's still Count Olaf.
He has a turban for religious reasons, Nero said, and running shoes because he's a coach. Look here.
He strode over to the computer and pressed a button. The screen began to glow in its usual seasick way, and once again showed a picture of Count Olaf.
You see, Coach Genghis looks nothing like Count Olaf, and my advanced computer system proves it.
Ushilo!
Sunny cried, which meant, that doesn't prove anything.
Ushilo!
Nero mocked.
Who am I going to believe? An advanced computer system, or two children flunking school and a little baby too dumb to make her own staples? Now stop wasting my time. I will personally oversee tomorrow's comprehensive exams, which will be given in the orphan shack. And you'd better do excellent work, or it's a free ride from Coach Genghis. Sayonara, Baudelaires!
Sayonara is the Japanese word for goodbye, and I'm sure that each and every one of the millions of people who live in Japan would be ashamed to hear their language used by such a revolting person. But the Baudelaire orphans had no time to think such international thoughts. They were too busy giving the Quagmire triplets the latest news.
This is awful,
Duncan cried as the five children trudged across the lawn so they could talk things over in peace. There's no way you can get an A on those exams, particularly if you have to run laps tonight.
This is dreadful, Isadora cried. There's no way you can make all those staples either. You'll be homeschooled before you know it.
Coach Genghis won't homeschool us, Violet said, looking out on the front lawn where the luminous Zero was waiting for them. He'll do something much, much worse. Don't you see? That's why he's made us run all those laps. He knew we'd be exhausted. He knew we'd flunk our classes or fail to perform our secretarial duties. He knew we'd be expelled from Prufrock Prep, and then he could get his hands on us. Klaus groaned. We've been waiting for his plan to be made clear, and now it is. But it might be too late. It's not too late, Violet insisted. The comprehensive exams aren't until tomorrow morning. We must be able to figure out a plan by then.
Plan?
Sunny agreed. It'll have to be a complicated plan, Duncan said. We have to get Violet ready for Mr. Ramora's test and Klaus ready for Mrs. Bass's test. And we have to make staples, Isadora said, and the Baudelaires still have to run laps. And we have to stay awake, Klaus said. The children looked at one another and then out at the front lawn. The afternoon sun was shining brightly, but the five youngsters knew that soon it would set behind the tombstone-shaped buildings, and that it would be time for S-O-R-E. They didn't have much time, Violet tied her hair up in a ribbon to keep it out of her eyes. Klaus polished his glasses and set them on his nose. Sunny scraped her teeth together to make sure they were sharp enough for any task ahead. And the two triplets took their notebooks out of their sweater pockets. Coach Genghis's evil plan had become clear through the prism of the Baudelaire and Quagmire experiences, and now they had to use their experience to make a plan of their own. Chapter 10. The three Baudelaire orphans and the two Quagmire triplets sat in the orphan's shack, which had never looked less unpleasant than it did now. All five children were wearing the noisy shoes Violet had invented, so the territorial crabs were nowhere to be seen. The salt had dried up the dripping tan fungus into a hard beige crust that was not particularly attractive, but at least did not plop drops of fungus juice on the youngsters. Because the arrival of Coach Genghis had focused their energies on defeating his treachery, the five orphans hadn't done anything about the green walls with the pink hearts on them. But otherwise the orphan shack had become quite a bit less mountainous and quite a bit more molehilly since the Baudelaire's arrival. It still had a long way to go to be attractive and comfortable living quarters, but for thinking of a plan, it would do in a pinch. And the Baudelaire children were certainly in a pinch. If Violet, Klaus, and Sunny spent one more exhausting night running laps, they would flunk their comprehensive exams and secretarial assignment. And then Coach Genghis would whisk them away from Prufrock Prep, and as they thought of this, they could almost feel Genghis's bony fingers pinching the life right out of them. The Quagmire triplets were so worried about their friends that they felt pinched as well, even though they were not directly in danger. Or so they thought, anyway. "I can't believe we didn't figure out Coach Genghis's plan earlier," Isadora said mournfully, paging through her notebook. "Duncan and I did all this research, and we still didn't figure it out." "Don't feel badly," Klaus said. "My sisters and I have had many encounters with Olaf, and it's always difficult to figure out his scheme." "We were trying to find out the history of Count Olaf," Duncan said. "The Prufrock Preparatory Library has a pretty good collection of old newspapers, and we thought if we could find out some of his other schemes, we might figure out this one."
"That's a good idea," Klaus said thoughtfully. "I've never tried that."
"We figured that Olaf must have been an evil man even before he met you," Duncan continued, "so we looked up things in old newspapers. But it was difficult to find too many articles, because as you know, he always uses a different name. But we found a person matching his description in the Bangkok Gazette, who was arrested for strangling a bishop but escaped from prison in just 10 minutes. "That sounds like him, all right," Klaus said. "And then in the Verona Daily News," Duncan said, "there was a man who had thrown a rich widow off of a cliff. He had a tattoo of an eye on his ankle, but he had eluded authorities. And then we found a newspaper from your hometown that said..." "I don't mean to interrupt," Isadora said, "but we'd better stop thinking about the past and start thinking about the present. Lunchtime is more than half over, and we desperately need a plan." "You're not napping, are you?" Klaus asked Violet, who had been silent for a very long time. "Of course I'm not napping," Violet replied. "I'm concentrating. I think I can invent something to make all those staples Sunny needs, but I can't figure out how I can invent the device and study for the test at the same time. Since S-O-R-E began, I haven't taken good notes in Mr. Romora's class, so I won't be able to remember his stories."
"Well, you don't have to worry about that," Duncan said, holding up his dark green notebook. "I've written down every one of Mr. Romora's stories. Every boring detail is recorded here in my notebook.
And I've written down how long, wide, and deep all of Mrs. Bass's objects are," Isadora said, holding up her own notebook. "You can study from my notebook, Klaus, and Violet can study from Duncan's."
"Thank you," Klaus said, "but you're forgetting something. We're supposed to be running laps this evening. We don't have time to read anybody's notebook."
"Tarkor," Sunny said, which meant, "You're right, of course. S-O-R-E always lasts until dawn, and the tests are first thing in the morning."
"If only we had one of the world's great inventors to help us," Violet said. "I wonder what Nikola Tesla would do."
"Or one of the world's great journalists," Duncan said. "I wonder what Dorothy Parker would do in this situation."
"And I wonder what Hammurabi, the ancient Babylonian, would do to help us," Klaus said. "He was one of the world's greatest researchers."
"Or the great poet Lord Byron," Isadora said.
"Shark," Sunny said, rubbing her teeth thoughtfully.
"Who knows what any of those people, or fish, would do in our shoes," Violet said. "It's impossible to know." Duncan snapped his fingers, not to signal a waiter or because he was listening to catchy music, but because he had an idea. "In our shoes," he said. "That's it."
"What's it?" Klaus said. "How will our noisy shoes help?"
"No, no," Duncan said. "Not the noisy shoes. I'm thinking about Coach Genghis's expensive running shoes that he said he couldn't take off because his feet were smelly."
"And I bet they are smelly," Isadora said. "I've noticed he doesn't bathe much."
"But that's not why he wears them," Violet said. "He wears them for a disguise."
"Exactly," Duncan said. "When you said, in our shoes, it gave me an idea. I know you just meant, in our shoes, as an expression meaning, in our situation. But what if someone else were actually in your shoes? What if we disguised ourselves as you? Then we could run laps and you could study for the comprehensive exams."
"Disguise yourselves as us," Klaus said. "You two look exactly like each other, but you don't look anything like us."
"So what?" Duncan said. "It'll be dark tonight. When we've watched you from the archway, all we could see were two shadowy figures running, and one crawling."
"That's true," Isadora said. "If I took the ribbon from your hair, Violet, and Duncan took Klaus's glasses, we'd look enough like you that I bet Coach Genghis couldn't tell.
And we could switch shoes, so your running on the grass would sound exactly the same," Duncan said.
"But what about Sunny?" Violet asked. "There's no way two people could disguise themselves as three people."
The Quagmire triplets' faces fell. "If only Quigley were here," Duncan said. "I just know he'd be willing to dress up as a baby if it meant helping you."
"What about a bag of flour?" Isadora asked. "Sonny's only about as big as a bag of flour. Nothing personal, Sonny."
"Donata," Sonny said, shrugging.
"We could snitch a bag from the cafeteria," Isadora said, "and drag it alongside us as we ran. From a distance, it would probably look enough like Sonny to avoid suspicion."
"Being in each other's shoes seems like an extremely risky plan," Violet said. "If it fails, not only are we in trouble, but you are as well, and who knows what Coach Genghis will do to you."
This, as it turns out, was a question that would haunt the Baudelaires for quite some time, but the Quagmires gave it barely a thought.
"Don't worry about that," Duncan said. "The important thing is to keep you out of his clutches. It may be a risky plan, but being in each other's shoes is the only thing we've been able to think of."
"And we don't have any time to waste thinking of anything else," Isadora added. "We'd better hurry if we want to snitch the bag of flour and not be late for class.
And we'll need a string or something so we can drag it along and make it look like Sunny crawling," Duncan said.
"And I'll need to snitch some things too," Violet said, "for my staple-making invention."
"Nidop," Sunny said, which meant something along the lines of, "Then let's get moving."
The five children walked out of the orphan's shack, taking off their noisy shoes and putting on their regular shoes so they wouldn't make a lot of noise as they walked nervously across the lawn to the cafeteria. They were nervous because they were not supposed to be sneaking into the cafeteria or snitching things, and they were nervous because their plan was indeed a risky one. It is not a pleasant feeling, nervousness, and I would not wish for small children to be any more nervous than the Baudelaires and the Quagmires were as they walked toward the cafeteria in their regular shoes. But I must say that the children weren't nervous enough. They didn't need to be more nervous about sneaking into the cafeteria, even though it was against the rules, or snitching things, even though they didn't get caught. But they should have been more nervous about their plan, and about what would happen that evening when the sun set on the brown lawn and the luminous circle began to glow. They should have been nervous, now, in their regular shoes, about what would happen when they were in each other's.
Chapter 11. If you've ever dressed up for Halloween or attended a masquerade, you know that there is a certain thrill to wearing a disguise, a thrill that is half excitement and half danger. I once attended one of the famed masked balls hosted by the Duchess of Winnipeg, and it was one of the most exciting and dangerous evenings of my life. I was disguised as a bullfighter and slipped into the party while being pursued by the palace guards, who were disguised as scorpions. The moment I entered the grand ballroom, I felt as if Lemony Snicket had disappeared. I was wearing clothes I had never worn before, a scarlet cape made of silk, and a vest embroidered with gold thread, and a skinny black mask, and it made me feel as if I were a different person. And because I felt like a different person, I dared to approach a woman I had been forbidden to approach for the rest of my life. She was alone on the veranda. The word veranda is a fancy term for a porch made of polished gray marble,
and costumed as a dragonfly, with a glittering green mask and enormous silvery wings. As my pursuers scurried around the party, trying to guess which guest was me, I slipped out to the veranda and gave her the message I'd been trying to give her for 15 long and lonely years. "Beatrice," I cried, just as the scorpion spotted me, "Count Olaf is..." I cannot go on. It makes me weep to think of that evening, and of the dark and desperate times that followed. And in the meantime, I'm sure you are curious what happened to the Baudelaire orphans and the Quagmire triplets after dinner that evening at Prufrock Prep. "This is sort of exciting," Duncan said, putting Klaus's glasses on his face. "I know that we're doing this for serious reasons, but I'm excited anyway." Isadora recited, tying Violet's ribbon in her hair. "It may not be particularly wise, but it's a thrill to be disguised. That's not a perfect poem, but it will have to do under the circumstances. How do we look?" The Baudelaire orphans took a step back and regarded the Quagmires carefully. It was just after dinner, and the children were standing outside the orphan shack, hurriedly putting their risky plan into action. They had managed to sneak into the cafeteria and steal a sunny-sized bag of flour from the kitchen, while the metal-masked cafeteria workers' backs were turned. Violet had also snitched a fork, a few teaspoons of creamed spinach, and a small potato, all of which she needed for her invention. Now they had just a few moments before the Baudelaires, or, in this case, the Quagmires in disguise, had to show up for S-O-R-E. Duncan and Isadora handed over their notebooks so the Baudelaires could study for their comprehensive exams, and switched shoes so the Quagmires' laps would sound exactly like the Baudelaires. Now, with only seconds to spare, the Baudelaires looked over the Quagmires' disguise and realized instantly just how risky this plan was. Isadora and Duncan Quagmire simply did not look very much like Violet and Klaus Baudelaire. Duncan's eyes were of a different color from Klaus's, and Isadora had different hair from Violet's, even if it was tied up in a similar way. Being triplets, the Quagmires were the exact same height, but Violet was taller than Klaus because she was older, and there was no time to make small stilts for Isadora to mimic this height difference. But it wasn't really these small physical details that made the disguise so unconvincing. It was the simple fact that the Baudelaires and the Quagmires were different people, and a hair ribbon, a pair of glasses, and some shoes couldn't turn them into one another, any more than a woman disguised as a dragonfly can actually take wing and escape the disaster awaiting her. "I know we don't look much like you," Duncan admitted after the Baudelaires had been quiet for some time, "but remember, it's quite dark on the front lawn. The only light is coming from the luminous circle. We'll make sure to keep our heads down when we're running, so our faces won't give us away. We won't speak a word to Coach Genghis, so our voices won't give us away. And we have your hair ribbon, glasses, and shoes, so our accessories won't give us away either." "We don't have to go through with this plan," Violet said quietly. "We appreciate your help, but we don't have to try and fool Genghis. My siblings and I could just run away right now, tonight. We've gotten to be pretty good runners, so we'd have a good head start on Coach Genghis." "We could call Mr. Poe from a payphone somewhere," Klaus said. "Zubu," Sonny said, which meant, "or attend a different school, under different names." "Those plans don't have a chance of working," Isadora said. "From what you've told us about Mr. Poe, he's never very helpful, and Count Olaf seems to find you wherever you go, so a different school wouldn't help either." "This is our only chance," Duncan agreed. "If you pass the exams without arousing Genghis's suspicion, you will be out of danger, and then we can focus our efforts on exposing the coach for who he really is." "I suppose you're right," Violet said. "I just don't like the idea of your putting your lives in such danger just to help us." "What are friends for?" Isadora said. "We're not going to attend some silly recital while you run laps to your doom. You three were the first people at Prufrock Prep who weren't mean to us just for being orphans. None of us have any family, so we've got to stick together." "At least let us go with you to the front lawn," Klaus said. "We'll spy on you from the archway and make sure you're fooling Coach Genghis." Duncan shook his head. "You don't have time to spy on us," he said. "You have to make staples out of those metal rods and study for 2 comprehensive exams." "Oh," Isadora said suddenly. "How will we drag this bag of flour along the track? We need a string or something." We could just kick it around the circle, Duncan said.
No, 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 Klaus said. If Coach Genghis thinks you're kicking your baby sister, he'll know something is up.
I know, Violet said. She leaned forward and put her hand on Duncan's chest, running her fingers along his thick wool sweater until she found what she was looking for, a loose thread. Carefully she pulled, unraveling the sweater slightly until she had a good long piece of yarn. Then she snapped it off and tied one end around the bag of flour. The other end she handed to Duncan. This should do it, she said. Sorry about your sweater. I'm sure you can invent a sewing machine, he said, when we're all out of danger. Well, we'd better go, Isadora. Coach Genghis will be waiting. Good luck with studying.
Good luck with running laps, Klaus said. The Baudelaires took a long look at their friends. They were reminded of the last time they saw their parents, waving goodbye to them as they left for the beach. They had not known, of course, that it would be the last moment they would spend with their mother and father. And again, each of the Baudelaires had gone back to that day in their lives, wishing that they had said something more than a casual goodbye. Violet, Klaus, and Sunny looked at the two triplets and hoped that this was not such a time when people they cared for would disappear from their lives forever. But what if it were? If we never see, Violet stopped, swallowed, and began again. If something goes wrong, Duncan took Violet's hands and looked right at her. Violet saw, behind Klaus's glasses, the serious look in Duncan's wide eyes. Nothing will go wrong, he said firmly, though of course he was wrong at that very moment. Nothing will go wrong at all. We'll see you in the morning, Baudelaires. Isadora nodded solemnly and followed her brother and the bag of flour away from the orphan shack. The Baudelaire orphans watched them walk toward the front lawn until the triplets were merely two specks, dragging another speck along with them. You know, Klaus said, as they watched them, from a distance, in the dim light, they look quite a bit like us. Abax, Sunny agreed. I hope so, Violet murmured. I hope so. But in the meantime, we'd better stop thinking about them and get started on our half of the plan. Let's put our noisy shoes on and go into the shack.
I can't imagine how you're going to make staples, Klaus said, with only a fork, a few teaspoons of creamed spinach, and a small potato. That sounds more like the ingredients for a side dish than for a staple-making device. I hope your inventing skills haven't been dulled by a lack of sleep.
I don't think they have, Violet said. It's amazing how much energy you can have once you have a plan. Besides, my plan doesn't only involve the things I snitched. It involves one of the orphan shack crabs and our noisy shoes. Now, when we all have our shoes on, please follow my instructions.
The two younger Baudelaires were quite puzzled at this, but they had learned long ago that when it came to inventions, Violet could be trusted absolutely. In the recent past, she had invented a grappling hook, a lockpick, a signaling device, and now, come hell or high water, an expression which here means using a fork, a few teaspoons of creamed spinach, a small potato, a live crab, and noisy shoes. She was going to invent a staple-making device. The three siblings put on their shoes and, following Violet's instructions, entered the shack. As usual, the tiny crabs were lounging around, taking advantage of their time alone in the shack when they wouldn't be frightened by loud noises. On most occasions, the Baudelaires would stomp wildly on the floor when they entered the shack, and the crabs would scurry underneath the bales of hay and into other hiding places in the room. This time, however, Violet instructed her siblings to step on the floor in carefully arranged patterns, so as to herd one of the grumpiest and biggest clawed crabs into a corner of the shack. While the other crabs scattered, this crab was trapped in a corner, afraid of the noisy shoes, but with nowhere to hide from them.
Good work, Violet cried. Keep him in the corner, Sonny, while I ready the potato.
What is the potato for? Klaus asked.
As we know, Violet explained as Sunny tapped her little feet this way and that to keep the crab in the corner. These crabs love to get their claws on our toes. I specifically snitched a potato that was toe-shaped. You see how it's curved in a sort of oval way, and the little bumpy part here looks like a toenail?
You're right, Klaus said. The resemblance is remarkable, but what does it have to do with staples?
Well, the metal rods that Nero gave us are very long and need to be cut cleanly into small, staple-sized pieces. While Sunny keeps the crab in the corner, I'm going to wave the potato at him. He, or she,
Come to think of it, I don't know how to tell a boy crab from a girl crab.
It's a boy, Klaus said. Trust me.
Well, he'll think it's a toe, Violet continued, and snap at it with his claws. At that instant, I'll yank the potato away and put a rod in its place. If I do it carefully enough, the crab should do a perfect job of slicing it up.
And then what? Klaus asked.
First things first, Violet replied firmly. Okay, Sonny, keep tapping those noisy shoes. I'm ready with the potato and rod number one.
What can I do? Klaus asked.
You can start studying for the comprehensive exam, of course, Violet said. I couldn't possibly read all of Duncan's notes in just one night. While Sonny and I make the staples, you need to read Duncan and Isadora's notebooks, memorize the measurements from Mrs. Bass's class, and teach me all of Mr. Remora's stories.
Roger, Klaus said.
As you probably know, the middle Baudelaire was not referring to anybody named Roger. He was saying a man's name to indicate that he understood what Violet had said and would act accordingly, and over the course of the next 2 hours, that's exactly what he did. While Sonny used her noisy shoes to keep the crab in the corner and Violet used the potato as a toe and the crab's claws as clean cutters, Klaus used the Quagmire notebooks to study for the comprehensive exams, and everything worked the way it should. Sonny tapped her shoes so noisily that the crab remained trapped. Violet was so quick with the potato and metal rods that they soon were snipped into staple-sized pieces. And Klaus, although he had to squint because Duncan was using his glasses, read Isidore's measuring notes so carefully that before long he had memorized the length, width, and depth of just about everything.
"Violet, ask me the measurements of the navy blue scarf," Klaus said, turning the notebook over so he couldn't peek.
Violet yanked the potato away just in time, and the crab snipped off another bit of the metal rods.
"What are the measurements of the navy blue scarf?" she asked.
2 decimeters long, Klaus recited, 9 centimeters wide, and 4 millimeters thick. It's boring, but it's correct. Sonny, ask me the measurements of the bar of deodorant soap.
The crab saw an opportunity to leave the corner, but Sonny was too quick for it.
Soap? Sonny quizzed Klaus, tapping her tiny noisy shoes until the crab retreated.
8 centimeters by 8 centimeters by 8 centimeters, Klaus said promptly.
That one's easy. You're doing great, you two. I bet that crab's going to be almost as tired as we are.
No, Violet said. He's done.
Let him go, Sonny. We have all the staple-sized pieces we need. I'm glad that part of the staple-making process is over. It's very nerve-wracking to tease a crab.
What's next? Klaus said, as the crab scurried away from the most frightening moments of his life.
Next, you teach me Mr. Remora's stories, Violet said, while Sonny and I bend these little bits of metal into the proper shape.
Shablow, Sonny said, which meant something like, how are we going to do that?
Watch, Violet said, and Sonny watched. While Klaus closed Isidore's black notebook and began paging through Duncan's dark green one, Violet took the glob of creamed spinach and mixed it with a few pieces of stray hay and dust until it was a sticky, gluey mess. Then she placed this mess on the spiky end of the fork and stuck it to one of the bales of hay so the handle end of the fork hung over the side. She blew on the creamed spinach, stray hay, and dust mixture until it hardened.
I always thought that Prufrock Prep's cream spinach was awfully sticky, Violet explained, and then I realized it could be used as glue. And now we have a perfect method for making those tiny strips into staples. See, if I lay a strip across the handle of the fork, a tiny part of the strip hangs off each of the sides. Those are the parts that will go inside the paper when it's a staple. If I take off my noisy shoes, and here Violet paused to take off her noisy shoes, and use the metal ends to tap on the strips, they'll bend around the handle of the fork and turn into staples. See?
Jeeba! Sonny shrieked. She meant, you're a genius, but what can I do to help?
You can keep your noisy shoes on your feet, Violet replied, and keep the crabs away from us. And Klaus, you start summarizing stories.
Roger, Sonny said.
Roger, Klaus said. And once again, neither of them were referring to Roger. They meant, once again, that they understood what Violet had said and would act accordingly, and all 3 Baudelaires acted accordingly for the rest of the night. Violet tapped away at the metal strips, and Klaus read out loud from Duncan's notebook, and Sonny stomped her noisy shoes. Soon, the Baudelaires had a pile of homemade staples on the floor, the details of Mr. Remora's stories in their brains, and not a single crab bothering them in the shack, and even with the threat of Coach Genghis hovering over them,
the evening actually began to feel rather cozy. It reminded the Baudelaires of evenings they had spent when their parents were still alive, in one of the living rooms in the Baudelaire mansion. Violet would often be tinkering away at some invention, while Klaus would often be reading and sharing the information he was learning, and Sunny would often be making loud noises. Of course, Violet was never tinkering frantically at an invention that would save their lives, Klaus was never reading something so boring, and Sunny was never making loud noises to scare crabs. But nevertheless, as the night wore on, the Baudelaires felt almost at home in the orphan's shack. And when the sky began to lighten with the first rays of dawn, the Baudelaires began to feel a certain thrill that was quite different from the thrill of being in disguise. It was a thrill that I have never felt in my life, and it was a thrill that the Baudelaires did not feel very often. But as the morning sun began to shine, the Baudelaire orphans felt the thrill of thinking your plan might work after all, and that perhaps they would eventually be as safe and happy as the evenings they remembered. Chapter 12. Assumptions are dangerous things to make, and like all dangerous things to make, bombs, for instance, or strawberry shortcake, if you make even the tiniest mistake, you can find yourself in terrible trouble. Making assumptions simply means believing things are a certain way with little or no evidence that shows you are correct, and you can see at once how this can lead to terrible trouble. For instance, one morning you might wake up and make the assumption that your bed was in the same place that it always was, even though you would have no real evidence that this was so. But when you got out of bed, you might discover that it had floated out to sea, and now you would be in terrible trouble all because of the incorrect assumption that you'd made. You can see that it is better not to make too many assumptions, particularly in the morning. The morning of the comprehensive exams, however, the Baudelaire orphans were so tired, not only from staying up all night studying and making staples, but also from 9 consecutive nights of running laps, that they made plenty of assumptions, and every last one of them turned out to be incorrect. "Well, that's the last staple," Violet said, stretching her tired muscles. "I think we can safely assume that Sunny won't lose her job." "And you seem to know every detail of Mr. Remora's stories as well as I know all of Mrs. Bass's measurements," Klaus said, rubbing his tired eyes. "So I think we can safely assume that we won't be expelled."
"Nearly go,"
Sunny said, yawning her tired mouth. She meant something like, "And we haven't seen either of the Quagmire triplets, so I think we can safely assume that their part of the plan went well."
"That's true," Klaus said. "I assume if they'd been caught, we would have heard by now."
"I'd make the same assumption," Violet said.
"I'd make the same assumption,"
came a nasty, mimicking voice. And the three children were startled to see Vice Principal Nero standing behind them, holding a huge stack of papers. In addition to the assumptions they had made out loud, the Baudelaires had made the assumption that they were alone, and they were surprised to find not only Vice Principal Nero, but also Mr. Remora and Mrs. Bass waiting in the doorway of the orphan's shack.
"I hope you've been studying all evening," Nero said, "because I told your teachers to make these exams extra challenging, and the pieces of paper that the baby has to staple are very thick. Well, let's get started. Mr. Remora and Mrs. Bass will take turns asking you questions until one of you gets an answer wrong, and then you flunk. Sunny will sit in the back and staple these papers into booklets of 5 papers each. And if your homemade staples don't work perfectly, then you flunk. Well, a musical genius like myself doesn't have all day to oversee exams. I've missed too much practice time as it is. Let's begin!"
Nero threw the papers into a big heap on one of the bales of hay, and the stapler right after it. Sunny crawled over as quickly as she could and began inserting the staples into the stapler, and Klaus stood up, still clutching the Quagmire notebooks. Violet put her noisy shoes back on her feet, and Mr. Remora swallowed a bite of banana and asked his first question.
"In my story about the donkey," he said, "how many miles did the donkey run?"
6,
Violet said promptly.
6,
Nero mimicked.
"That can't be correct, can it, Mr. Remora?"
Yes, actually,
Mr. Remora said, taking another bite of banana.
"How wide," Mrs. Bass said to Klaus, "was the book with the yellow cover?"
19 centimeters,
Klaus said immediately.
19 centimeters,
Nero mocked.
"That's wrong, isn't it, Mrs. Bass?"
No,
Mrs. Bass admitted.
That's the right answer.
Well, try another question, Mr. Remora,
Nero said.
In my story about the mushroom,
Miss Remora asked Violet,
what was the name of the chef?
Maurice,
Violet answered.
Maurice,
Nero mimicked.
Correct,
Mr. Remora said.
How long was chicken breast number 7?
Mrs. Bass asked. 14 centimeters and 5 millimeters, Klaus said.
14 centimeters and 5 millimeters,
Nero mimicked.
That's right,
Mrs. Bass said.
You're actually both very good students, even if you've been sleeping through class lately. Stop all this chit-chat and flunk them, Nero said. I've never gotten to expel any students, and I'm really looking forward to it. In my story about the dump truck,
Mr. Remora said, as Sunny began to staple the pile of thick papers into booklets,
what color were the rocks that it carried?
Gray and brown.
Gray and brown!
Correct.
How deep was my mother's casserole dish?
6 centimeters.
6 centimeters!
Correct.
In my story about the weasel, what was its favorite color?
The comprehensive exams went on and on, and if I were to repeat all of the tiresome and pointless questions that Mr. Remora and Mrs. Bass asked, you might become so bored that you would go to sleep right here, using this book as a pillow instead of as an entertaining and instructive tale to benefit young minds. Indeed, the exams were so boring that the Baudelaire orphans might normally have dozed through the test themselves, but they dared not doze. One wrong answer or unstapled piece of paper, and Nero would expel them from Prufrock Preparatory School and send them into the waiting clutches of Coach Genghis. So the three children worked as hard as they could. Violet tried to remember each detail Klaus had taught her. Klaus tried to remember every measurement he had taught himself. And Sunny stapled like mad, a phrase which here means quickly and accurately. Finally, Mr. Remora stopped in the middle of his 8th banana and turned to Vice Principal Nero.
Nero, he said, there's no use continuing these exams. Violet is a very fine student, and has obviously studied very hard.
Mrs. Bass nodded her head in agreement.
In all my years of teaching, I've never encountered a more metric-wise boy than Klaus here. And it looks like Sunny is a fine secretary as well. Look at these booklets, they're gorgeous!
Pilso, Sunny shrieked. My sister means thank you very much, Violet said, although Sunny really meant something more like, my stapling hand is sore. Does this mean we get to stay at Prufrock Prep?
Oh, let him stay, Nero,
Mr. Remora said.
Why don't you expel that Carmelita Spatz? She never studies, and she's an awful person besides.
Oh, yes,
Mrs. Bass said.
Let's give her an extra challenging examination.
I can't flunk Carmelita Spatz,
Nero said impatiently.
She's Coach Genghis's special messenger.
Who?
Mr. Remora asked.
You know,
Mrs. Bass explained.
Coach Genghis, the new gym teacher.
Oh, yes, Mr. Remora said. I've heard about him, but never met him. What is he like?
He's the finest gym teacher the world has ever seen,
Vice Principal Nero said, shaking his 4 pigtails in amazement.
But you don't have to take my word for it. You can see for yourself. Here he comes now.
Nero pointed one of his hairy hands out of the orphan shack, and the Baudelaire orphans saw with horror that the vice principal was speaking the truth. Whistling an irritating tune to himself, Coach Genghis was walking straight toward them, and the children could see at once how incorrect one of their assumptions had been. It was not the assumption that Sunny would not lose her job, although that assumption, too, would turn out to be incorrect. And it was not the assumption that Violet and Klaus would not be expelled, although that, too, was a wrong one. It was the assumption about the Quagmire triplets, and their part of the plan going well. As Coach Genghis walked closer and closer, the Baudelaire saw that he was holding Violet's hair ribbon in one of his scraggly hands, and Klaus's glasses in the other, and with every step of his expensive running shoes, the coach raised a small white cloud, which the children realized must be flour from the snitched sack. But more than the ribbon, or the glasses, or the small clouds of flour, was the look in Genghis's eyes. As Coach Genghis reached the orphan shack, his eyes were shining bright with triumph, as if he had finally won a game that he had been playing for a long, long time. And the Baudelaire orphans realized that the assumption about the Quagmire triplets had been very, very wrong indeed. Chapter 13.
Where are they? Violet cried as Coach Genghis stepped into the shack. What have you done with them?
Normally, of course, one should begin conversations with something more along the lines of, Hello, how are you? But the eldest Baudelaire was far too distressed to do so. Genghis's eyes were shining as brightly as could be, but his voice was calm and pleasant.
Here they are,
he said, holding up the ribbon and glasses.
I thought you might be worried about them, so I brought them over first thing in the morning.
We don't mean these them,
Klaus said, taking the items from Genghis's scraggly hands.
We mean them them.
I'm afraid I don't understand all those thems,
Coach Genghis said, shrugging at the adults.
The orphans ran laps last night as part of my S-O-R-E program, but they had to dash off in the morning to take their exams. In their hurry, Violet dropped her ribbon and Klaus dropped his glasses. But the baby...
You know very well that's not what happened, Violet interrupted. Where are the Quagmire triplets? What have you done with our friends?
What have you done with our friends?
Vice Principal Nero said in his mocking tone.
Stop talking nonsense, orphans. I'm afraid it's not nonsense,
Genghis said, shaking his turbaned head and continuing his story.
As I was saying before the little girl interrupted me, the baby didn't dash off with the other orphans. She just sat there, like a sack of flour. So I walked over to her and gave her a kick to get her moving.
Excellent idea, Nero said. What a wonderful story this is. And then what happened?
Well, at first it seemed like I'd kicked a big hole in the baby,
Genghis said, his eyes shining.
Which seemed lucky, because Sunny was a terrible athlete, and it would have been a blessing to put her out of her misery.
Nero clapped his hands.
I know just what you mean, Genghis, he said. She's a terrible secretary as well. But she did all that stapling,
Mr. Remora protested.
Shut up and let the coach finish his story,
Nero said.
But when I looked down,
Genghis continued,
I saw that I hadn't kicked a hole in a baby. I'd kicked a hole in a bag of flour. I'd been tricked.
That's terrible, Nero cried.
So I ran after Violet and Klaus,
Genghis continued,
and I found that there weren't Violet and Klaus after all, but those two other orphans, the twins.
They're not twins, Violet cried. They're triplets.
They're triplets,
Nero mocked.
Don't be an idiot. Triplets are when four babies are born at the same time, and there are only two Quagmires.
And these two Quagmires were pretending to be the Baudelaires in order to give the Baudelaires extra time to study.
Extra time to study? Nero said, grinning in delight. He, he, he. Why, that's cheating.
That's not cheating,
Mrs. Bass said.
Skipping gym class to study is cheating, Nero insisted. No, it's just good time management,
Mr. Remora argued.
There's nothing wrong with athletics, but they shouldn't get in the way of your schoolwork. Look, I'm the vice principal,
the vice principal said.
I say the Baudelaires were cheating, and therefore, hooray! I can expel them. You two are merely teachers. So if you disagree with me, I can expel you too.
Mr. Remora looked at Mrs. Bass, and they both shrugged.
You're the boss, Nero,
Mr. Remora said finally, taking another banana out of his pocket.
If you say they're expelled, they're expelled. Well, I say they're expelled, Nero said. And Sunny loses her job, too.
Ranta!
Sunny shrieked, which meant something along the lines of, I never wanted to work as a secretary anyway. We don't care about being expelled, Violet said. We want to know what happened to our friends.
Well, the Quagmires had to be punished for their part in the cheating,
Coach Genga said.
So I brought them over to the cafeteria and put those two workers in charge of them. They'll be whisking eggs all day long.
Very sensible,
Nero agreed. That's all they're doing? Klaus said suspiciously. Whisking eggs?
That's what I said,
Genga said, and leaned so close to the Baudelaires that all they could see were his shiny eyes and the crooked curve of his wicked mouth.
Those two Quagmires will whisk and whisk until they are simply whisked away.
You're a liar, Violet said.
Insulting your coach, Nero said, shaking his pigtailed head. Now you're doubly expelled. What's this? Said a voice from the doorway. Doubly expelled?
The voice stopped to have a long, wet cough, so the Baudelaires knew without looking that it was Mr. Poe. He was standing at the orphan shack, holding a large paper sack and looking busy and confused.
What are all of you doing here? He said. This doesn't look like a proper place to have a conversation. It's just an old shack. What are you doing here?
Nero asked.
We don't allow strangers to wander around Prufrock Preparatory School. Poe's the name, Mr. Poe said, shaking Nero's hand. You must be Nero. We've talked on the phone. I received your telegram about the 28 bags of candy and the 10 pairs of earrings with precious stones. My associates at Mulctuary Money Management thought I'd better deliver them in person, so here I am. But what's this about expelled? These orphans you foisted on me, Nero said, using a nasty word for gave, have proven to be terrible cheaters, and I'm forced to expel them. Cheaters? Mr. Poe said, frowning at the three siblings. Violet, Klaus, Sunny, I'm very disappointed in you. You promised me that you'd be excellent students.
Well, actually, only Violet and Klaus were students, Nero said. Sunny was an administrative assistant, but she was terrible at it as well.
Mr. Poe's eyes widened in surprise as he paused to cough into his white handkerchief.
An administrative assistant?
He repeated.
Why, Sunny's only a baby. She should be in preschool, not an office environment.
Well, it doesn't matter now, Nero said. They're all expelled. Give me that candy.
Klaus looked down at his hands, which were still clutching the Quagmire notebooks. He was afraid that the notebooks might be the only sign of the Quagmires he would ever see again.
We don't have time to argue about candy, he cried. Count Olaf has done something terrible to our friends.
Count Olaf?
Mr. Poe said, handing Nero the paper sack.
Don't tell me he's found you here.
No, of course not, Nero said. My advanced computer system has kept him away, of course, but the children have this bizarre notion that Coach Genghis is actually Olaf in disguise.
Count Olaf,
Genghis said slowly.
Yes, I've heard of him. He's supposed to be the best actor in the whole world. I'm the best gym teacher in the whole world, so we couldn't possibly be the same person.
Mr. Poe looked Coach Genghis up and down, and then shook his head.
A pleasure to meet you,
he said, and then turned to the Baudelaires.
Children, I'm surprised at you. Even without an advanced computer system, you should be able to tell that this man isn't Count Olaf. Olaf has only one eyebrow, and this man is wearing a turban. And Olaf has a tattoo of an eye on his ankle, and this man is wearing expensive running shoes. They are quite handsome, by the way.
Oh, thank you, Coach Genga said. Unfortunately, thanks to these children, they have flour all over them. But I'm sure it'll wash off.
If he removes his turban and his shoes, Violet said impatiently, you will be able to see that he's Olaf.
We've been through this before, Nero said. He can't take off his running shoes because he's been exercising and his feet smell.
And I can't take off my turban for religious reasons,
Genghis added. You're not wearing a turban for religious reasons, Klaus said in disgust, and Sunny shrieked something in agreement. You're wearing it as a disguise. Please, Mr. Poe, make him take it off.
Now, Klaus, Mr. Poe said sternly, you have to learn to be accepting of other cultures.
I'm sorry, Coach Genghis. The children aren't usually prejudiced.
That's quite all right, Genghis said. I'm